work takes up most of your time. That's why you should use Stamps.com to save time with your mailing and shipping. Stamps.com will simplify your postage needs and add valuable time back into your workday, so you have flexibility to focus on more important things. Stamps.com can handle your mailing and shipping needs with rates up to 88% off UPS and USPS. Send invoices, checks, certified mail, packages, and anything else you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. If you sell online, connecting with every major marketplace and shopping cart is easy. Plus, you can schedule package pickups through their dashboard and automatically see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers with Stamps.com's Rate Advisor. Add more flexibility to your workday with Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com/program to sign up for a special offer. No contract, cancel anytime. That's Stamps.com/program.
89% of business leaders say AI is a top priority. The right choice is crucial, which is why teams at one-third of Fortune 500 companies use Grammarly. Grammarly is the right AI assistant for your team. With top-tier security credentials and 15 years of experience in responsible AI, Grammarly is how companies like yours increase productivity while keeping data protected and private. See why 70,000 teams trust Grammarly at grammarly.com/enterprise.
Things aren't always as they appear, and some bombshells might be hiding in plain sight. I'm Katie Bilotti, and this is Found Objects, a storytelling history podcast. Welcome in, everyone. Welcome back to Found Objects History Podcast with me, Katie Bilotti. I have my voice back this week. You guys might recall last week I said in the intro I was really struggling with my voice, and I definitely still have allergies, but I sound a lot better and I feel a lot better. So thank you for bearing with me last week. I mean, granted, I did have a story on deck to share. Like, I had planned ahead somehow, which is really me turning a new leaf because I'm typically not a content planner like that. But yeah, we're back and I'm filming or recording rather a fresh episode of the pod. And this story is something that is really strange. Okay. Like, this is strange is the word that I think most accurately describes this story. It's a roller coaster, to say the least. So you will need to buckle up and pay attention because it is really surprising. Okay, that's another word, surprising. And I'm very excited to get into it because this is a story that I'd never heard of before. Again, I was on Reddit, just, you know, doing my thing and stumbled across this and was shocked by the headline that I saw. So everyone, gather around. I'll be sharing a story today that has a bunch of different elements. We have a stealthy kidnapping in this story. We have a supposed change of heart, a girl gone wild, and one of the longest FBI manhunts in recent history. All that and more on this episode of Found Objects. We'll unpack the events of Patty Hearst's life from 1974 to 1975. So we're going back to the 70s, like last week. And yeah, it involves a capture, a kidnapping of a helpless college student to a criminal capture later on. So yeah, and you know what? I'm not even going to say anymore because I think it's time we just get into it and I stop rambling because I know by now you're definitely on the edge of your seat. So let me dispel the mystery and share this story, this strange story of Patty Hearst. I want you to imagine yourself at dinner with your friends. This might be something you do often. I know I do. I'm often out with my friends at dinner with a drink in hand, usually a dirty martini, and we're gossiping because let's be real. That's what happens when you're, you know, out with your girlfriends or whoever, you know, the conversation does kind of tilt towards gossip every once in a while, right? Or every time, maybe. So, you know, you're covering all the bases. You're covering who's dating who, you know, who got this new job and who didn't and who, you know, is moving to this place and with who and who got married and who's having kids. And you're just having the usual gossipy banter. And then your best friend turns to you and says, if you were on a deserted island, what three things would you bring with you and why?
Like, what are the three most important things? Like, that sort of question. Or there's a different variety of, if your house was on fire and you could only grab a couple of things, what would those things be? You know, this is a question we probably have heard before, maybe in like a classic icebreaker scenario. But it's one of those classically interesting conversation topics because everyone tends to have a different response. And, you know, you thought about it yourself countless times because hasn't everyone? It's the go-to hypothetical worst case scenario question. It's not morbid, it's just interesting. You know, I think we've all let our minds go there sometimes, though, whether it's for fun or to make light of a terrible situation we hope to never be in. I'm sure you've also considered your death row meal, right? That's another question people ask, or, you know, things like that. But you, of course, don't think you're going to go to jail. Like, you think about that question, like, oh, what's your death row meal, aka what's that last meal you would choose to have before going to the electric chair if, you know, if you were on death row. But of course, you think about that in a funny hypothetical sense, not in a way where you think you're ever going to go to jail, right? What about how you would rob a bank? None of these are outside the realm of random conversation amongst friends at a dinner table. But what about this? Have you ever considered what you would do if you were kidnapped? Would you play the perfect prisoner in the hopes that you can convince your kidnapper that they made a grave mistake and they should let you go? Would you lay low and dig your way out of your cell with a plastic spoon, Shawshank Redemption style? Or would you join the enemy? Not to infiltrate their ranks and take them down from within because you don't agree with them. No, because you actually grow to believe their cause and had a change of heart. That's exactly what happened in the crazy, infamous tale of the kidnapping of Patty Hearst, heiress turned potential terrorist. Okay, let's back things up and talk about the upbringing of Patty Hearst, our main character. So Patty was born in San Francisco, California in 1954. She was the third of five daughters of Randolph A. Hearst and attended private schools up and down the coast of California throughout her childhood until she was accepted into the University of California at Berkeley for her undergraduate degree. Perhaps most importantly, she was the granddaughter of publishing tycoon William Randolph Hearst. And I've actually been to the Hearst building, Hearst headquarters here in New York City, a handful of times over the years. It's this very beautiful building, very distinct looking building, Hearst Tower, I think it's what it's actually called, like the actual term for it. But I always wondered, I'm like, Hearst, like, who is Hearst? Who is the original Hearst? So at the height of William Randolph Hearst's newspaper empire, Hearst owned 28 newspapers nationwide, and among them were the Los Angeles Examiner, the Boston American, the Chicago Examiner, the Detroit Times, the Washington Times Herald, the Washington Herald, and his flagship, the San Francisco Examiner. So a bunch of different publications. And that translates to, of course, a lot of money. This important detail is what led to the unfortunate series of events that unfolded on the night of February 6th, 1974, the night that Patty Hearst's life would change forever, marking the start of one of the strangest kidnapping cases ever documented in the history of the U.S. So at this point in our story, Patty Hearst is 19 years old, and she is engaged to be married to a man named Stephen Weed, and the two of them were together enjoying a night in at her apartment near the Berkeley campus. She was at home hunkering down, starting to study for the night, wearing a blue bathrobe. They were just relaxing on the couch when they heard a knock at the door. And they noted it was kind of odd for that to happen at that point in the night, despite Patty's wariness, which I'd be wary as well. I'd be like, look through the peephole at least. Steve opens the door. And he left Patty in the foyer, opens the door, only to find a group of men and women waiting on her doorstep. They mumbled something about having car trouble, so she turned away, annoyed to be disturbed by something so trivial at this late hour. She's like, you know what? I'm going back to studying. These people can, you know, Steve can handle it, right? So with Patty's defenses down, she turned away. They blindfolded her. They grabbed her, blindfolded her, beat the crap out of her fiance, Steve, and then made their escape. They threw Patty into the trunk of an awaiting car outside and drove off into the night. And this whole thing, like, this happened in, like, the span of, like, a few minutes, crazy how your night can completely change from lounging on the couch in your cute blue bathrobe about to study, like having a chill night with your fiance, to your fiance getting beat up and you being stuffed in a trunk. Like, it just goes to show you got to be careful. And I always think this, I'm like, I'm way too trusting. If I saw someone at the door being like, oh, I have car trouble, you know, it would take everything in my body, every bone in my body, to be like, Katie, no, do not open the door. Do not open the door. Even if like my boyfriend was here, granted, I live in New York City, that doesn't really happen where people come up to your door and ask for help with their car, like your specific apartment building or your apartment, you know, door, because there's so many apartments in, you know, a normal building. But alas, I feel like I now hearing these stories, I'm like, wait a minute, I need to be more wary about these things. Anyway, so Patty Hearst is in the trunk of a car, freaking out, most likely, in her blue bathrobe. That's where we've left her in this story. And it turns out later on, we find out that the people that kidnapped her were actually a group of armed radicals that billed themselves as the Symbionese Liberation Army, or the SLA. So the leader of the SLA was a criminal named Donald DeFries, and they wanted nothing less than to incite a guerrilla war against the US government and destroy what they called the, quote, capitalist state. And their ranks included a mixed bag, okay? Women and men, blacks and whites, anarchists and extremists from various walks of life. And they were, in short, a band of domestic terrorists. They were against the government and they wanted to destroy that, quote, capitalist state. They were dangerous. They were armed and dangerous. They had already shot two Oakland school officials with cyanide-tipped bullets, killing one and seriously wounding the other. And though the group had never had more than 11 or 12 members at any time, they were still a small but mighty operation. So why did they take Patty Hearst? What did they want with her? And were they going to kill her? Like, that must be a question in your mind right now. So think about it. Like, obviously, what this terrorist organization wants most of all is for people to start paying attention, for people to know who they are, fear them, and obviously, you know, they want their ideas out there. So what is the best way to get your ideas out there? I don't know, maybe kidnapping the granddaughter of this newspaper tycoon. So then the SLA manifesto and name, at least, would be plastered on every newspaper in the country, right? Like that, you know, is kind of, that makes me, that's what I initially thought, was like, okay, that must be their goal. And it was, and it worked. The country was hooked. They were like, where is this, you know, this heiress? Where have they gone? What have they done with her? That got people's attention and it got their name on people's radars. So back to Patty. While she was detained, she was apparently brainwashed under humiliating conditions of confinement in a closet. So I guess, you know, you can think about people in prison when they're in solitary confinement. Like, people tend to go a bit insane if they're exposed to absolutely nothing but just walls and themselves and the agony of overthinking and wondering if you're ever going to see the people you love ever again. So Patty was in this confined space. She was in this closet at the SLA apartment hideaway for weeks on end. And the SLA's intentions with Patty became clear as the weeks went on. They started to force her to record audio tapes that they would release to the public as a form of ransom. On the tapes, Patty demanded millions of dollars worth of food and donations to feed the homeless and needy in exchange for her release, which is interesting. So I guess that was one of their goals. They wanted the homeless and needy to be fed, which sounds noble, but they were still keeping this Patty as a prisoner and torturing her. So, you know, not great. While the demands were exorbitantly priced, ridiculously priced, even for a super wealthy family like the Hearsts, Patty's parents, of course, wanted their daughter back, so they did whatever they could. They gave away that $2 million worth of food to the poor in the San Francisco Bay Area. $2 million worth of food. As the food was tossed off trucks in the neighborhoods of needy people in San Francisco and Oakland, mobs fought angrily for the supplies, then broke bitterly into small-scale rioting when the gifts ran out. So, yeah, so it sounds like even with $2 million worth of food and resources donated by the Hearst, that still, like, wasn't enough because riots literally formed over it. So word of this got back to the SLA, and they then urged the Hearst to donate more, to try harder for the sake of their daughter's life. They mocked the family for their, quote, measly attempt to solve this pressing nationwide problem of hunger. And then they made sure to tell Patty all of that and more. They told her that her family didn't care enough about her to donate enough food. And they convinced her that she obviously wasn't worth much to her father if $2 million was all that they would shell out for her ransom. Like, again, they were a wealthy family. $2 million is not a measly sum, but to them, it could have been. So they convinced her. They pretty much were like, Patty, your family doesn't love you. And she's confined to this closet. So, of course, she's already going crazy just in that confined space for the weeks that she's been confined and held captive. And then she's hearing that her family doesn't care about her. So it's just absolute torture probably to hear those sorts of things. They continuously berated her family as well and tried to coerce her into seeing the intent of the SLA mission. And over time, Patty began to believe them. 9 weeks after her capture, another audio tape came out. And this one was more jarring than any of the others combined. On the tape, Patty calmly declared that she had joined the SLA. "I have chosen to stay and fight," she said. She called her father a liar for claiming to be concerned about her well-being and that of, quote, oppressed people. And she insisted that she had not been brainwashed, she had not been drugged, tortured, or hypnotized in any way by her abductors. She made it very clear that she was on their side, which is crazy. Like, you know, of course, she was captured by these people, and now she's decided to, you know, come out with this tape. But of course, you still think, like, okay, maybe she's being, like, held at gunpoint to make these statements, right? Like, this, how do you join the side of these people that derailed your life? Anyway, so included with the tape that came out was a snapshot of Patty holding up an automatic rifle in front of an SLA Cobra poster. And it was a photo that would be singed into the memories of the American public in 1974. Like, it was a very famous, scary image. You can still Google it today. And I'll have it on the Instagram. If you guys want to check out the Found Objects podcast Instagram, I always put visuals from the episode. Give us a follow. Anyway, so perhaps Patty wanted everyone to know that she was not a helpless, kidnapped woman anymore, that she chose to stay of her own free will. But this didn't stop her family from staying hopeful, as they still thought that she had somehow been mentally coerced into submission, had been brainwashed. Nothing else in their minds could explain this sudden change of heart. She was a young, wealthy woman whose biggest concern was picking out which china pattern to put on her wedding registry. And now they were supposed to believe that she was this woman wielding a rifle? Like, how did 9 weeks really change her? Which, honestly, 9 weeks, that's a long time. That's over 2 months to be held captive. Like, one could assume that you would do just about anything to get your captors to let you go after that point. So again, maybe she's, you know, going along with this as a kind of, she's faking it, you know? Yet, not even 2 weeks after she pledged her allegiance to the SLA, Patty was seen on security footage robbing a bank with her new pals. Yes, robbing a bank. Maybe she was the kind of girl who knew how to brandish a rifle after all. The video showed Patty slowly walking into a Hibernia bank branch in San Francisco with a group of 4 other people. Upon entering, they yelled, quote, "We're from the SLA, and this is Tanya Hurst." It became clear that they were putting on a show with this robbery and this declaration, a show for the public to illuminate the fact that Patty Hurst was gone, and Tanya Hurst, member of the SLA and woman capable of robbing a bank, was born. So Tanya, or Patty, is now Tanya. Like, she rebranded herself. So after they made this bold declaration, they then shot up the bank for no reason before fleeing with about $10,900, which is roughly $67,000 in today's money. And they put on a show, and the show was a success, because in response to the security camera footage, Patty Hearst's distraught father said, quote, "It's terrible. 60 days ago, she was a lovely child. Now there's a photo of her in a bank with a gun in her hand." A short time later, so after the bank incident, Patty was seen again shooting at a storefront from the SLA getaway car as her friends slash accomplices tried to steal a pair of 49-cent socks. 49-cent socks. It's what it sounds like, okay? A shootout over socks. Absolutely absurd. Anyway, so this unhinged behavior begs the question, what was actually going on with Patty Hearst? Were her mental faculties still in check? Like, was she losing it? Psychiatrists who specialize in treating disturbed young people have their theories about Patty's behavior. Some believe that her motivations were far more complex than a simple and misdirected zeal to reform the world. They see her as an extreme example of the phenomenon of white middle class or rich girls turning to violence to strike at society. So, you know, people that have it all, that have every fortune in life, acting out because they don't know what else to do. Like, you see this all the time, actually. You really do. A lot of celebrities and whatnot. But that quote was directly from a Time magazine article from 1975. So reminder, we are in the 70s at this point. Sociologist Louis Yablonsky of California State University at Northridge believed that Patty Hearst acted like a robot. He claimed that women like Patty, quote, with no definite ego of their own, place themselves in a total subservient position, following orders. They have low or no self-esteem, and they're desperately seeking recognition and approval. Typical of their craving for attention is the fact that they have no regard for their own safety. They're more dangerous because of that. So kind of scalding, honestly. It's kind of mean. Like, Patty's just, submissive in this whole scenario. Like, you know, it begs the question right now, does she know what she's doing? Is she doing this because it will ensure her safety? And, you know, after she gains the trust of her captor, she'll eventually get out? Or did she actually, you know, is she actually submissive and allowed herself to be brainwashed? Or thirdly, like, did she decide, oh, wait, this is actually a great cause, you know? I want to join willingly. But many believe that there is an actual name for what Patty was maybe experiencing. And that explanation is called Stockholm Syndrome, which you might have heard of before. There's some songs about it and various other things. And this was actually my first thought when I first started reading into Patty's story. I was like, oh, this sounds a lot like Stockholm Syndrome. And Stockholm Syndrome is a psychological response where a hostage, like Patty, you know, begins to identify closely with his or her captors, as well as with their agenda and demands. So you kind of, it's a brainwashing of sorts, where if you spend enough time with these people and you're scared of them, your body kind of retreats into this stress response of joining them. It's like that quote, like, if you can't beat them, join them. The name of this syndrome, Stockholm Syndrome, is actually derived from a bank robbery gone wrong in Stockholm, Sweden. Did you know? It's a really interesting story, actually, but SparkNotes version, in August of 1973, so same time period as the Patty Hearst of it all, four employees of this bank in Sweden were held hostage in the bank's vault for 6 days. And during the standoff, a seemingly incongruous bond developed between the captors and captees, which is really interesting. Like, I totally, when I first read about Stockholm Syndrome, I'm like, there's no way, they were definitely faking it. But there were multiple very proving factors of this story. One of the hostages during the bank robbery in Sweden, actually during a telephone conversation with the Swedish prime minister, stated that she fully trusted her captors, but feared that she would die in a police assault on the building. So, like, she was afraid of the people that were trying to save her over these people that had literally captured her and held her hostage. Like, she started to trust the people that had held her hostage more than law enforcement. Psychologists who have studied Stockholm Syndrome believe that the bond is initially created when a captor threatens a captive's life, deliberates, and then chooses not to kill the captive. So they kind of, like, decide they're going to kill them, or, like, say that they're going to kill them, and then be like, yeah, you know what? Maybe I'll save you then. Maybe I won't do it. And so then the captive's relief at the removal of the death threat is transposed into feelings of gratitude. You know, you're feeling grateful, you're feeling so happy and relieved that your captor is being kind, that you start to kind of see them as this kind person when they're literally not. Like, they were going to kill you, and they still can kill you, you know? So the survival instinct is at the heart of the Stockholm Syndrome phenomenon. Victims live in enforced dependence and interpret rare or small acts of kindness from their captors in the midst of this horrible, horrible situation that they're going through as good treatment. And they often become hypervigilant to the needs and demands of their captors, making psychological links between the captor's happiness and their own. So they become kind of intertwined with these people that making their life miserable, but they're just so grateful that they're still alive that they start to resort to, you know, kind thoughts about their captor. And even in Patty's case, joining their cause. So among experts, the most infamous example of Stockholm Syndrome, like if you read reports and books about this, they often always mention Patty Hearst. We will, of course, analyze what caused her to switch to the dark side soon, but regardless, the crazy behavior continued to puzzle the FBI in their search and hopes of bringing her home safely. Then they had a big break in May of 1974. On May 16th, two SLA members tried to steal an ammunition belt from a local store and were nearly caught. The getaway van was discovered, which led authorities to an SLA safe house. On May 17th, an army of 410 agents and highly armed policemen cornered half a dozen members of the SLA in a small rose-colored safe house in the south central section of Los Angeles. They pumped more than 5,000 rounds of ammunition into the house and a fierce gun battle ensued. The building caught on fire and burned to the ground, and there were six charred bodies in the smoldering debris, including that of the leader, Donald DeFries. But Patty had managed to escape the shootout. Thus ensued one of the longest manhunts in the history of the FBI. It took almost 19 and a half months to capture Patty and the remaining SLA accomplices. She was thought to have been on the run with a couple named Bill and Emily Harris. And Bill and Emily, they had a very similar SLA indoctrination story to Patty's story, minus the kidnapping. They grew up in stable, well-off homes with families who loved them until radicalism somehow infiltrated their lives. Bill was the son of a building supply salesman and grew up in Carmel, Indiana. He was a good kid, but his wartime service as a combat marine in Vietnam turned him towards radicalism. Once he left the service, he supported the Vietnam Veterans Against the War and associated with Venceremos, quote, "We Shall Conquer," which is a Maoist revolutionary group. So Emily, that was Bill, Emily, his wife, was from Clarendon Hills, Illinois, a Chicago suburb. Her father was a consulting engineer, village board member, and Boy Scouts backer. And at Indiana University, Emily was a fashionably dressed member of Chi Omega sorority, one of the most exclusive campus societies, and she later taught in Bloomington schools. So they seem, you know, like normal people, but then they met in 1970, they were married and moved to California in 1971, and when she and Bill moved to Berkeley, both of them became involved in prison reform and drifted into radical activities, and this is likely where they became heavily involved with the SLA. So it's an unlikely trio out on the road together, this couple and then newspaper heiress, Patty Hearst, but they are suspected to be some of the only SLA members left after the shootout and fire in LA. They stayed radio silent, but they were on the move. Patty was reportedly sighted as far as Hong Kong, Cuba, Mexico City, Algeria, and as close as on a Los Angeles freeway, in the hills of Tennessee, and in a Colorado cafe. So she was spotted in all sorts of places, just on the run. And it wasn't until June 7th, 1974, that station KPFK received a tape recording of Patty's voice. This is one of the only attempts that she made to contact the public during this time. And the radio station was unsure what to expect from the recording, perhaps a cry for help, begging her family to forgive her maybe. Instead, what they received was a eulogy for one of the shootout victims, William Wolfe, so one of her co-SLS members. In it, Patty said, quote, "His love for the people was so deep that he was willing to give his life for them." She said she had called him Cujo, and she said, quote, "We loved each other so much." So it sounds like she had not only been swept off her feet by the SLA, but also this Cujo guy. Is he the reason that she decided to join the cause and, you know, give in to her captors? Was she just this love-struck 19-year-old willing to do anything to prove her loyalty to her crush? Love seems like one of the few reasons that could justify her shift to the dark side. But she also had a fiance. Like, what about Steve Weed, you know? Which I have to say is such an interesting name. Steve Weed. Didn't really mention that earlier when I said his name, but I was thinking it. But given the whole kidnapping and then being beat up thing, it didn't feel right. But anyway, so not only was this the longest FBI manhunt in history, it was also the most embarrassing. The agents started acting recklessly and overzealously the more desperate they got. Because, I mean, imagine, I bet they're getting a lot of negative press. I mean, of course, it's, you know, the press that the family is the press, right? The Hearst family, but also probably direct anger from this wealthy family, you know? Like, I'm just sure they're under a lot of pressure, which, you know, of course, it's high stakes here. This is a girl's life, and something clearly is going wrong or is up with her, you know, joining a terrorist organization. But they started acting recklessly. They, you know, for example, about 50 Los Angeles police officers staged a pre-dawn raid on a Hollywood home, awakening two sleepy women in pajamas who vaguely resembled Patty and Emily Harris. A young woman seemingly meditating in a subway station in New York Times Square resisted efforts of New York police to check her identity against that of Patty. Scores of American women were stopped along the Mexican border and even in Central American tourist spots like Honduras because of real or imagined resemblances to Miss Hearst. So they started seeing mirages of Patty Hearst. They thought they saw her around. And so there was a lot of, you know, cases of mistaken identity, but you know, police like storming with like guns to wake two sleeping women in the middle of the night in their pajamas, you know, with their hands up like, oh my God, why are you here? Who are you? You know, and it's not Patty Hearst. So on their manhunt, when they were trying to find Patty and the Harrises, they actually ended up stumbling across a hideout for a particularly violent group called the Weathermen. So a different group. This is different than SLS. And I actually watched a documentary on the Weathermen on Netflix, I think, or HBO or one of them. Very, very interesting. It's a very similar situation where it's these wealthy, a lot of the people involved were very wealthy, well-to-do kids. Like they're, you know, kids of parents that, you know, were very wealthy and maybe a bit absent. And they got together and decided to like, you know, they created a bomb, like all this stuff. So definitely look into the Weathermen if you have time. But supposedly, when the FBI were looking for, specifically for Patty Hearst and the Harrises, these members of the SLS group, they stumbled across a hideout for the Weathermen and almost got their hands on the Weathermen leader. So they almost infiltrated this other group when they were trying to find Patty Hearst. So just kind of an interesting aside. So essentially, word got out because of this. So the Weathermen, I guess, then were aware of Patty Hearst and were like, oh my God, we cannot protect this woman because then we're going to get caught. So news spread like wildfire to stay away from Patty because she had eyes on her. So all these other radical groups that maybe Patty could fit into or she could, you know, try to get some help from, you know, were like, absolutely not, get away from us. Like, you're going to get us caught. So after that, Patty and her friends, the Harrises, struggled to find safe houses, to find refuge. And so then they were more vulnerable for the FBI to eventually find them. Randomly enough, three main things were their kryptonite. The beginning of the end, if you will. The clues that ultimately led to their capture were three things. Number one, a fingerprint in a Pennsylvania farmhouse. Number two, a red Volkswagen. And number three, a post office box in San Francisco. Patty and the Harrises stayed in Pennsylvania for a time, but evaded law enforcement before they caught wind of that safe house. So they got out before the FBI could track them down to that safe house. After scouring the farmhouse, though, the FBI found the fingerprints of Wendy Yashimura, a known SLA co-conspirator, which positively linked her with the fugitives. So they didn't find fingerprints of Patty Hearst's, but they found this other person, Wendy Yashimura's fingerprints, which was a known co-conspirator. So they linked it. They were like, okay, this is close enough. And then the red Volkswagen was reportedly spotted at the same farmhouse. And a former owner of the car told authorities that he had sold it to a woman named Kathleen Salaya, who had given her address as a post office box number in San Francisco. And they looked into this a bit further, and they learned that Salaya had been friendly with SLA members and other radicals. So another link, not exactly to Patty Hearst, but to the organization. So they were getting warmer. And then, so then what they did was they set up surveillance on Kathleen Salaya's postal box in San Francisco and discovered that mail was being picked up by messengers and taken to two addresses, 288 Procida Avenue and 625 Morse Street. Turns out, they didn't even need to stake out those addresses for long. They had hit the jackpot. Once the FBI had this trail, they were all quickly busted. The Harrises were apprehended at 288 Procida Avenue. Patty and Wendy Yashimura were apprehended at 625 Moore Street. A man named, quote, Charlie Adams had signed the lease for that house and paid rent at 625 Morris Street. And later, authorities established that, quote, Adams was Stephen F. Celaya, the brother of Kathleen Celaya. So the Celaya family, where they had their claws deep in the SLS organization, even though they weren't known members, they had helped them. And Celaya was arrested at the apartment and charged with harboring fugitives from the law. Once Patty was finally found, both of her parents came to meet her in San Francisco. I mean, imagine how freaked out you must be as a parent to have lost your kid and now she's not at all like how she used to be. Like, how scary that would be and how much you would want to see them, right? And like get them back to how they were before, or just, you know, just see them and make sure they're okay. So when her mother heard the news about her daughter, quote, I sat down in a chair and said a silent prayer of thanks. I'm just thankful to God that she's alive. In response to Patty working with radical groups, her mom said, quote, I don't believe she has given up 19 years of our lives together so completely. If she went one way, she can go the other way. When you all love each other, everything can be worked out. Was Patty's mom being, I don't know, too optimistic with this? Like, do you think that after a year of fleeing government officials, you'd be hopeful that your daughter was not acting of her own free will? After seeing all the photos, like the one of her holding a machine gun and video of her robbing a bank and all of the other things, evading capture for so long, you know, it's hard to say, but it's amazing that her parents still believed her after all of this time. Like, they still believed that a switch could be flipped and she could go back to normal. Like, clearly this was just how she had to survive. You know, they really believed that to their core, especially because it was noted that she only reluctantly agreed to meet with her parents after her arrest. She kind of wanted nothing to do with them. So in terms of sentencing, because of course she did commit crimes, so, you know, naturally that would result in some sort of sentence. She faced 5 counts of assault with an intent to commit murder, 4 counts of robbery, 5 counts of assault with a deadly weapon, 3 counts of felony auto theft, and 2 counts of kidnapping. It's crazy. She was charged with kidnapping, which means like she literally did to other people what had happened to her. It's just baffling to me. Like, I have chills thinking that. Anyway, so during her preliminary court appearance, Patty Hearst pled not guilty on all counts. Not surprisingly, the defense strategy harped on Stockholm syndrome. They tried to paint the picture of a troubled daughter as a girl who had somehow been influenced or directed by SLA members to commit this host of crimes. At the time, when interviewed, her dad said, quote, I don't think very much is going to happen to her because she was a kidnap victim. Of course, there will be a hassle and I can see a lot of bumpy roads ahead, but I don't think that this is anything. So at the trial, that's exactly what they tried to convince the jury of. The defense focused not only on her physical abuse, but on the pervasive brainwashing by her attackers that caused her to sympathize with them. However, the prosecution had some damning evidence up their sleeves that made it very clear that Patty knew what she was doing with the SLA. Namely, they showed a video from her jail cell. The recording shows Patty Hearst talking with a friend in which she was confident, cursing, and fully aware of her role with the Symbionese Liberation Army. So ultimately, the defense didn't work, and Patty Hearst was convicted of bank robbery on March 20th, 1976. So this is the next year. You know, she was kidnapped in 1974. 2 years later, she's sentenced to jail. She was imprisoned for almost 2 years, so now we're in 78. But then interestingly, Jimmy Carter commuted her 7-year sentence and freed her from jail. Then President Bill Clinton granted her a full pardon on the last day of his presidency, January 20th, 2001. In the end, the irony of it all, the irony of Patty's story, really lies in the fact that, you know, she was this newly reborn Tanya Hearst, revolutionary, badass woman with a gun, you know, hates the government, hates the fact that she was born from money and, you know, all of this. She still had to rely on her parents' money for her freedom. A family whose fortune came from a system that she supposedly wanted to overthrow. The Hearsts paid her bail, paid for her attorneys, paid for the presidential clemency campaign, and from there, she kind of defaulted into her old life again. Isn't that crazy? Like, I have chills. Like, she, after all this, after all of these counts of things that she didn't even serve a sentence for, but were clearly, you know, there was proof to show that she had done all these things. She had kidnapped, she had robbed, she had, you know, done all this stuff, and like, there's recordings of her saying, like, I believe in the movement, I hate the government, I hate my family, blah, blah, blah. She ended up reverting back to her normal life after she was freed. She married her bodyguard while on bail, former San Francisco cop Bernard Shaw. She became a mother, a grandmother, philanthropist, actress even, novelist, and Westminster Kennel Club competition winner. Yes, she's well known actually for her award-winning French bulldogs. This crazy saga unfolded 50 years ago exactly. And my biggest question here still is, was Patty brainwashed or not? You know, was she acting by her own free will? Did she, you know, really believe in this cause that the SLA was gunning for? Or was she just trying to stay alive? Did she maybe lose herself in the process of all of this and the trauma of trying to process the fact that she was kidnapped, like, got to her? I mean, the jury's still out because she seemingly fell back into her normal life pretty easily. But in my opinion, there are three perspectives to consider regarding her kidnapping and allegiance to this terrorist organization, the SLA. The first theory is that she was in on it from the beginning. In her extensive interview with People magazine in 1982, so, you know, almost a decade after she was kidnapped, she said herself that her fiancé Steve was arrogant and condescending. In her relationship with Steve, she wondered if she traded parental authority for spousal authority and reiterated her unhappiness. So, you know, she'd gone through a life of, you know, growing up with her family kind of, you know, directing her, telling her what to do. And then she was about to marry into a life of her fiancé and then husband, Steve, telling her what to do. So is it so outside the realm of possibility that the perfect daughter and perfect fiancé was eager for a drastic change? A rebellious phase, perhaps. Could she have staged her own kidnapping? That is a theory people have. They're like, did she set this up so she could, you know, get out of the shackles of her life? Maybe she met Cujo, the man that she professed her love to, on the radio, and he convinced her to join the revolution, and they cooked up a plan to have her fake kidnapped and Steve beat up so she could get out of there. So that's theory number one. Theory number two is that Patty was in fact a victim of Stockholm Syndrome and was brainwashed throughout the duration of her time with the SLA. And the idea is that over time, she really did believe the teachings of the SLA and what they stood for. She was told that her family no longer cared about her and, you know, that the FBI was abandoning all attempts to rescue her. And she didn't have any proof of that. She didn't have access to the newspapers and whatnot. So she believed them, and she, you know, would then kind of abandon the fact that she was going to get freed and then cling to the love and hope for her future that was, you know, being provided to her by her captors, by the SLA. And as we know, this is a variation of what was used in her defense team's strategy when she was on the stand. But, and this kind of tracks if you consider the fact that she committed some heinous crimes, like some really terrible crimes while she was at the SLA. Like, why else would she do these things? Like, if she wasn't brainwashed. So the third and final theory is that she just made decisions as rationally as she could in order to survive. Like, she did what she could with what she had. And in Patty's own words, in 1982, she claimed that of the SLA, quote, I could not have cared less about their communist claptrap. In fact, I barely understood what they were talking about. My own best course of action, the only one I could see open to me, was to humor them. Listen to them, I told myself, and do exactly what they want. Somehow, sometime, I would be rescued. She mentioned that the more agreeable she was to be educated on Marxist literature, the more friendly they became. And then she said that when they ultimately presented her with the opportunity of becoming an SLA member and joining the cause, and, you know, then that, therefore, being freed from her closet, like, she was in this closet, trapped in this confined four-wall situation where she was going crazy, and they said, you know, we'll let you go, we'll let you out of here if you join us, you know, we'll let you out of this closet and, you know, you can become one of us. So she decided in that moment that was the only realistic choice that would not lead to her death. And apparently the SLA leader had told her while she thought about it, while she deliberated, quote, you know, we've gotten to kind of like you, so we don't really want to kill you if we don't have to. Think about it. Interestingly, she also mentioned Cujo in this 1982 interview. She said it very briefly, trigger warning, assault, but she essentially said that Cujo had sexually abused her and they were not in love, despite what she publicly proclaimed. Just something to note. So, okay, those are the three theories that the public has deliberated over for the past, I don't even know how many years, like many years now. I mean, that was back in the 70s when this first happened. So, you know, 50 years now. And let's remember this third theory that came straight from Patty's mouth. This is what she wants us to think in hindsight. You know, the interview where, quote, Patty tells all is several years after this all went down. So is she trying to, you know, has she had time to think about it? Has she been media trained to change her story? You know, I'm not saying I don't believe the victim because, you know, I usually tend to believe the victim, but is she a victim? I mean, she's a victim of the initial kidnapping, but then she went on to do some terrible things. Like she committed these heinous crimes. She kidnapped people as well. So it just really is food for thought. It's something to think about. You know, the interview where she tells all is several years after this all went down, like to reiterate. So has she had time to then formulate her story and get it airtight by the time she's sitting down and talking about this? Are we being manipulated even though we were taught to always believe the victim? Is she regretful of what she did while she was an SLA member and she's trying to do right and pave over things and, you know, keep her family's good name by saying that she was doing it just to survive, you know? Or, you know, do we really need to believe her? Like, is this really a story of someone that just did what they had to do to survive? Reflecting back on that video footage that was captured in the jail when she was awaiting sentencing, awaiting her hearing, she literally in the jail cell was proclaiming that she was still pro SLA. Why would she do that in the jail cell? Like that, like, you know, she was already captured or recaptured in the sense that she was free. She was with the good guys. She was in jail, you know, away from the SLA. She was with authorities and her family knew where she was and she was like in the clear. Why would she then be like, no, pro SLA if, you know, she's in the clear now? So it's very confusing to me. But yeah, my next and final question is, why in the world did she get this special treatment from the presidents? Why was she pardoned? Why was she granted clemency? You know, why was she not left to serve her whole sentence? Like, her sentence was only 7 years, which isn't even that long. Like, why was she granted this special treatment? Why is there no information on why she was pardoned? That's the most important question here, because there's nothing. All accounts just say it happened and leave it at that, but there's got to be a story here. Did her family buy her way out of it, out of the trouble? Did the story somehow capture the heart of not one, but two presidents? Some experts say that the presidential action on the Hearst's behalf is an example of, quote, wealth and privilege in action, as I suspected, honestly. The fact that she went from being, you know, in her blue bathrobe on her couch with her fiance to being kidnapped, thrown into a trunk, then, you know, whatever you believe, whether she was brainwashed or what, decides to act alongside the SLA terrorist agency, you know, causing all of this harm to people and to, you know, causing fear in America and, you know, all for the sake of anti-government ideas and whatever, doing that to then getting sentenced to prison for, you know, robbing the bank, only gets like a year or whatever she got, and then being pardoned by two presidents randomly, then just living a normal life after that, marrying her bodyguard, just becoming a normal member of society, like a rich woman in society, not denouncing her wealth anymore. Like she's fully like just back to the way she was. She's like, you know, I'm proud to be a Hearst, right? Like she's not proclaiming, like, I'm just wondering what shifted and like how, I have so many questions. And the only person that knows the true answer is Patty Hearst. So yeah. And Patty Hearst is, she's still alive today. She's 70 years old. And yeah, it looks like, I'm just Googled her just to see. She was captive for a total of 22 months. And today she's just hanging out with her French bulldogs and winning prizes. So yeah, mind blown from this story. I know it's one of those you'll think about for days afterwards, but yeah, we unpacked a lot. There's a lot to consider. All three of those different theories that I discussed. And, you know, which perspective do you believe? I highly recommend at your next dinner party, at your next restaurant hang, your next gossip session with your friends, ask the question, have you heard of Patty Hearst? And when you tell them the story, be like, what would you do in this situation? Do you think she was lying? Like, you know, there's just so many questions attached to the Patty Hearst of it all. And this might be the next death row meal conversation starter. Like, what would you do if you were Patty Hearst? And do you believe her? No harm, no foul, because, you know, of course, Patty is now living her best life as we speak with her award-winning show dogs, and all is well, supposedly. I mean, again, we don't know what kind of mental trauma she might be going through still after all of this, and to this day, I hope she's well, but I'm genuinely so curious about what the truth is here. You know, I don't think we'll ever know. And with that, guys, another episode in the books. Thank you guys for listening. Follow us over on Found Objects Podcast on Instagram. And again, I'll have photos of Patty and various other things tied to this story over on Instagram. So check that out. Give us a 5-star review if you think we are 5 stars material. I love our little corner of the internet. So thank you for being here. And remember, things aren't always as they appear. Goodbye. This episode was produced, edited, and told by Katie Bellotti. Research by Sarah Schilling. Podcast artwork by Siri Devlin. Follow us on Instagram at Found Objects Podcast. Tune in next Wednesday for a new episode. Goodbye.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.